know that there were organizations, but on our pamphlet, we were really happy to be able to add something from Fred Rogers, who's helped so many American children over the years over TV, because one of the things that he says over and over again is, when you're in trouble, find a helper. And we want to encourage people to reach out. One thing we know is that trauma tends to silence people, and it tends to not be spoken of. And so we just wanted the pamphlet to be a catalyst so that things that weren't thought to be spoken of could really be spoken of with people who can help.
Nancy Burke, we want to thank you so much for being with us, psychoanalyst, co-chair of the Psychotherapy Action Network. We will link to the pamphlet you published aimed at helping immigrants' parents separated from their children. I'm Amy Goodman. This is Democracy Now!
Dearborn Homecoming is coming up for its 39th year, so join WHFR at the festival August 3rd through 5th from Ford Field Park when we set up a record sale and meet your favorite DJs. Go to thecityofdearborn.org to learn more about the weekend's entertainment featuring the Australian Bee Gees Show and the legendary Homecoming Fireworks on Saturday and Sunday. The 39th annual Dearborn Homecoming will feature rides, music, vendors, food, and community high school reunions on August 3rd through 5th at Ford Field Park, located at 500 Monroe Street.
Once upon a time, there was a nice house that lived with a family. The house loved the family and took care of them. One day, it started to rain and rain. The house wanted to protect the family, but the water got inside and ruined everybody's everything. The house was so sad, but the family didn't think it could happen. They told the house that they would take better care of her, always.
Protect what matters. Learn more about your flood risk at floodsmart.gov/care.
Broadcasting from the campus of Henry Ford College, this is WHFR Dearborn. Listener-supported, non-commercial radio. Featuring local and independent artists.
It's WHFR 89.3, also online at WHFR.FM, making waves. I'm Alan Mazurek. Susan McGraw and I are continuing our little summer vacation here from the new WHFR Journal so that we can bring you another very fascinating series of programs that we have found. This one deals with education in America. It's called Degrees of Separation, and it's going to run for the next few weeks in place of the new WHFR our journal. Don't worry, we will be back in due time with a fresh take on the new WHFR journal. We do hope you'll stick around and enjoy this program. It's a part of our public service to you, our listeners, as we look at education in America on the program Degrees of Separation. Here on WHFR, we're always making waves.
From the Virginia Foundation for the Humanities, this is With Good Reason. Teachers face an uphill struggle, from low pay and large classes to a lack of autonomy.
We've just endured more and more cuts, so we're seeing a lack of resources at unprecedented levels.
And how high teacher turnover and low morale affects our kids.
You know, what does it mean in a school if a fifth to a quarter of the full-time teachers leave every school year?
Plus, the consequences for the country of an unequal education.
Inequality is the Achilles heel in American education, and that will, if not corrected, haunt this country for many decades to come.
All this and more today on With Good Reason. First, the news.
Henry Ford College provides a strong foundation for students pursuing a career in education, offering a two-year associate's degree in pre-education as well as pre-secondary and special education. For more information about HFC's pre-education degrees, please call 313-845-6430 or check out the pre-education program guide at hfcc.edu/programs.
You know what really gets a party started? Indoor baseball. Yeah, just find a broom or a pool cue, and you can use, like, anything as a ball. Cans, bottles, shoes.
Hey, bro, toss me that avocado. Most party fouls are pretty dumb, but if you decide to drink and drive underage, you could lose your license and your freedom. Underage drinking and driving, the ultimate party foul. Learn more at ultimatepartyfoul.org. Brought to you by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration and the Ad Council.
It had happened within a school year. So many changes. Changes that had taken so much out of teaching.
This is from a 1950s documentary on classroom overcrowding. It shows that 60 years later, not too much has changed. Teachers today face even bigger classrooms, and they do it with less. Less funding, less support, and less control over their classroom. Perhaps it's no surprise that many teachers are deciding to leave the profession.
Reasons? How does a teacher explain her reasons for resigning?
I'm Sarah McConnell, and today on With Good Reason, we bring you the fifth in our special series on education and inequality. We look at the formidable obstacles faced by classroom teachers every day, from standardized testing to terrible pay to a loss of autonomy in the classroom. And we'll hear the reasons teachers give for leaving the profession. We begin with the story of Oklahoma teacher Sean Sheehan. Here's associate producer John Last.
Sean Sheehan was Oklahoma's State Teacher of the Year. But as of this fall, Sean Sheehan won't be a teacher in Oklahoma at all. Instead, he's going to be 3 hours south in Fort Worth, Texas. To understand why Oklahoma's former Teacher of the Year is leaving the state, let's go back to when he first won the award.
My role as Oklahoma's Teacher of the Year was to travel and speak around the state.
That's Sean.
And there were two main audiences that I spoke with. One was folks who were interested in becoming teachers, and so my role there was boosting their morale and encouraging them that they had made the right choice to teach. And then the second audience was current teachers. It was easy to convey my enthusiasm for this profession that I love. The harder part was talking financials.
The starting salary for teachers in Oklahoma is a little over $31,000 a year. That's about $20,000 less than the average college grad's starting salary. Sean found himself in the awkward position of trying to pump up new graduates to enter a profession that made it hard to make ends meet. And the terrible pay wasn't the only problem with being a teacher in Oklahoma. In fact, it wasn't even the main problem. Sean says that when he was traveling the state and speaking to teachers,
my perspective on what was going on in education in the state of Oklahoma grew immensely. We're seeing a lack of resources at unprecedented levels. We're having so many positions cut, support staff are being cut. We're doing more with less and with more and more students in our classrooms.
Sean always thought he'd stay in Oklahoma and try and change things for educators. He even ran for state senate on a platform of greater funding for schools, but he lost to a candidate who ran on school choice. Then, about 8 months ago, Sean had a baby. Sean's wife is an educator, too, and between their two salaries, they were just scraping by.
And so I am making the decision that is best for me and my family. I mean, as soon as I cross the border, I will immediately be making a salary that's higher than a number I could ever see after even 32 years of teaching in the state of Oklahoma.
And to be clear, that's not a fortune, more like a living wage. Sean says when he made his decision public, a lot of other teachers who quit or moved away came out of the woodwork to support him. He says teachers tend to leave the state with their heads down.
That was a complicated decision for sure, and it came with much heartache, to be completely honest, to go from representing the state as one of the kind of highest awarded teachers to now almost a martyr of sorts. The hardest thing is there are faces of students that I can picture right now that I had just this last year who, when I told them that I was leaving, their eyes kind of dropped. They'd look down at their feet, you know. They don't know what to think. And yet, one student had said, "Wow, so you're like the 12th teacher I know that's not coming back.
Oklahoma's teacher shortage continues. Just last month, the Board of Education approved 220 emergency teaching certificates, almost three times as many as this time last year.
That was With Good Reason associate producer John Last, speaking with Oklahoma State Teacher of the Year for 2016, Sean Sheehan. Sadly, Sheehan's story is not remarkable. Every year, thousands of teachers across the country make the decision to leave the profession. But low salaries are only one part of the equation. Richard Ingersoll is a professor of education and sociology at the University of Pennsylvania Graduate School of Education and an expert in the reasons teachers quit their jobs. Richard, America is facing its first major teacher shortage since the 90s. Is the shortage of teachers because they're leaving the profession or because we're not generating enough new teachers in the schools?
It's both. Because of the recession, the hiring of teachers dropped dramatically, and there was even layoffs. This is between 08 and 012. And so enrollments in the teacher training, teacher education programs dropped. But as in the past, the biggest factor behind the demand and the difficulty filling classrooms with qualified teachers is turnover, is teachers departing teaching way before retirement.
Is that mostly because wages are too low?
No, it's not. The data clearly show that salaries and benefits are not the only nor the main reason why teachers depart from their schools. There's a whole host of working conditions which bother teachers enough that they either leave teaching or they switch schools.
What's the worst? What do they hate the most?
Well, one of the biggest issues, there's several, but one of the biggest issues is how much voice do teachers have in the key decisions in the building that affect their jobs? And related to that, the issue of how much discretion and leeway and autonomy are we going to give them within their classrooms?
Why do teachers feel they don't have power and authority? They are the solo rulers in the classroom, right?
Well, yes. And there is this old notion that the teacher can close the classroom door and do exactly what they want and ignore the directives from on high. But particularly in an area of testing and accountability, that is not true. It never was true. Whatever you do in the classroom is very much shaped by these other constraints. I mean, the time you have, the curriculum materials you have, how much authority do you have to discipline your students? With testing, the idea is we're gonna get in there. We're going to invade that classroom and find out just how much your students are learning, and we're going to hold you accountable for it. It was very one-sided. We increased the pressures, the accountability, the scrutiny of teachers, but we did not, for the most part, increase the tools, the time, the autonomy, the resources, the rewards, the training, et cetera, to sort of help them and reward them for meeting the high bar.
You taught at one time, and you left the profession after 6 years, and it wasn't so much because you lacked autonomy.
Well, that was a gripe of mine. That was a complaint that I was kind of shocked. I first began my teaching career in Western Canada. I was living out there after college and taught in the Canadian public schools for a while and then moved back east. I grew up near Philadelphia. And I was shocked. The job was very different. There, at least in the schools in which I taught, you had a lot. You were something of a professional. And here, you had very little. And if you tried to voice things, sometimes you were just told to shut up.
What's a small thing that was frustrating that you really didn't have autonomy with here, but you did there?
Well, one issue is this thing we call out-of-field teaching. That's where a teacher is assigned to teach subjects that they don't have any background in. It doesn't fit their degree or their teaching license or both. And I'd never encountered that in Canada. When I came here, it seemed to be the norm in both public and private schools. 2 days before school would start, I'd get a memo from the principal. You know, Mr. Ingersoll, we're dropping your senior elective in world problems, and you'll be teaching two sections in Algebra 10. you know, that I'd never taught before. I didn't have a clue how to do it. Yeah, I like to think I did an okay job teaching algebra, but frankly, no. The kids, algebra is tough to teach, and those who have some background in it, I'm sure, did a much better job than I. Ultimately, it hurts the students, and in my case, it was very frustrating. It was one of the issues that drove me out.
What's the turnover rate in the teaching profession, and who have you found in your research is most likely to leave?
The annual turnover rate is 16 to 17% or so, and it's gone up slightly over the last couple decades. Some of those are, about half of those are getting out of teaching altogether, and about half are going to other schools. And those rates are relatively high compared to many other occupations and professions.
What about new teachers? What is that rate?
New teachers are amongst the highest. Somewhere between 40 and 50% of those who come into teaching are gone within 5 years. And we've done this research in the last couple years, and we found that minority teachers quit at distinctly, significantly higher rates than non-minority teachers. This is a very important finding because there's been this big concern the last couple decades that we have a minority teacher shortage. Two-thirds of the states have minority teacher recruitment initiatives, and there's been a lot of success, it turns out. The numbers of minority teachers over the last couple decades have more than doubled. There's been sort of an unheralded success story, but there's a huge but. Minority teachers have been coming in at faster rates, but they've also been leaving at faster rates.
Are there any models that come to your mind of schools that have done a good job of retaining their minority teachers?
There are a small handful of these initiatives that do recruitment and retention. They follow these candidates in. They try to give them some support in the first few years. Those are where things need to go as far as improving the minority teacher shortage.
Does the teacher shortage hurt poorer schools more than it hurts the wealthy ones?
Yes. Back to where you asked me earlier, what are the rates of turnover of teachers? I kind of gave you the annual rate across the nation. But what that overall rate masks is the huge differences between different types of schools in the rate at which they lose teachers. And unfortunately, the more disadvantaged the school, the higher the poverty level, the higher the teacher turnover levels. It's not equally distributed at all. In fact, we calculated this, that almost half of the outflows of teachers every year, teacher turnover across the whole nation, occurs in only a quarter of the schools. It's highly concentrated.
And that must be so disruptive to learning.
Yes. What's interesting is when I first started doing this research a couple decades ago, it was hard to find anyone who'd looked at the possible costs and consequences of the high levels of turnover in the teaching occupation. You know, what does it mean in a school if a fifth to a quarter of the full-time teachers leave every school year, mostly at the end of the school year? I mean, what does that mean to sort of the coherence of the place and running the place and having any kind of ongoing sense of community? And besides money, besides the cost of high levels of turnover, there's all kinds of costs and consequences that we're only just now starting to understand and do research on.
So there's a wide gap in teacher salaries also. Rich schools pay high, poor schools pay low.
That is correct. So the United States is a little different compared to many other nations. We have this thing called local control. We have 13,000 some school districts. And a lot of the revenue for K through 12 education comes from local property taxes. To this day, that's one of the factors behind the huge differences in the salaries. One of the results is that there's lots of flows of teachers each and every year between school districts. The numbers moving from poorer to more affluent districts is four times than the reverse.
So stepping back and looking at the high turnover rates and the teaching force in general, do you have some thoughts about what our best practices might be to help alleviate that?
When I was a school teacher, it was what we called the old sink or swim model. You got the job, the principal gave you a pat on the back, gave you the key to your classroom, and that was it. You were on your own. And some made it and some didn't. And this is one of the factors behind those very high rates of attrition, of quitting amongst beginning teachers that we mentioned earlier. So there's been a lot of thought given into this. And in the last couple decades, there's been a growth, support initiatives, support activities for beginning teachers. Having a mentor, having a veteran teacher given some time off and assigned to some beginning teachers or a beginning teacher to help them learn the ropes, first survive, and then succeed. These beginners that get this kind of support, does it make their classroom teaching better? Does it show up and improve student scores? Does it help their retention? And we have now a number of studies that show that, yes, there's positive effects of these types of programs. So that's one thing that we now have a solid research base showing that it helps beginning teachers, helps their classroom teaching, helps student achievement, helps their retention.
Richard Ingersoll is a professor of education and sociology at the University of Pennsylvania Graduate School of Education. If classroom teachers want respect and autonomy more than anything else, how can schools change to keep them happy? It turns out we've had an answer to this question since the 1970s, when one radical educator in East Harlem experimented with the school governed by its teachers. Deborah Meyer helped found the small schools movement with her school at Central Park East. Now she's an outspoken advocate for involving teachers and students in the decisions that affect their classrooms. Deborah, you are one of the most prominent thinkers on the subject of teacher governance, but everyone starts somewhere, and for you, it was as a substitute teacher in Chicago in the 1960s. What were your first impressions of the work of an educator?
It was the most humiliating job I had ever experienced. And not only were the children treated without much respect, but the adults in the building weren't either. And that was a shock to me.
Help us understand what sort of experience children were getting in the public schools of the 1960s.
Well, my children went to public schools in New York during a very difficult period in the late 60s. And when I went to see the principal there to complain to him about some modest violence on the staircases, he told me that, well, my child shouldn't be going to this school. This school was not meant for people like you. It was a little bit like a prison. They were waiting for a riot. The children outnumbered us, after all. It was that kind of tension.
Looking back on it, do you think that it would have been possible as a substitute or a young new teacher to have made a difference in an environment like that?
Yes, I think under the worst of circumstances, some people manage to do amazing things. But we can't build a system for a few million children on the basis of adults who are miracle workers.
When you did have your own classroom, you used it to develop what you called an open classroom model. What do you mean when you say open classroom?
I guess it means open to the children's interests. And I'm told that there was a post-World War II development in England in which the teachers, having spent the wartime in a relationship with children that was very different, decided that children were interesting.
Right.
And why not have an interesting place for adults and children to work together and uncover the world rather than cover it? When I took the job then as a morning kindergarten teacher, that's what I did. I just created a room that was as interesting to me as I hoped it would be to children. And it turned out I was right. My children were interested in sand and water and paints and clay and books and beautiful books, preferably. And left to their own devices, so to speak, with a teacher who carefully orchestrated things. Children had enormous attention spans, and low-income black children had strong and interesting vocabularies and stories to tell. And they were full of curiosity, and they were budding intellectuals.
Do you think of yourself as creating the small schools movement in New York City?
Well, what I think is that I assumed that small schools was the norm, and was startled by how large public schools tended to be.
How large are we talking about were the schools you encountered in New York?
The big ones in New York, well, elementary schools are between 1,000 and 1,500. High schools, 3,000, 4,000. Wow. So the smallness is simply that it makes it easier to know each other and to exchange ideas together and for the staff to sit around a table together and talk about what's going on in their school. Besides which, it was frequently the only way you could get more autonomy. And it was, in a way, an accident in New York. Some superintendent, new young superintendent, came to East Harlem. He came to see me and said, would you like to have your own school in a part of one of the existing school buildings? And I jumped at the chance and started a school which we called Central Park East in East Harlem, which was largely, entirely low-income minority community, most probably 60-70% Latino.
Give us a feeling for the kind of experiences students and teachers would have had in something that wasn't one of these small schools, and by contrast, what they experienced in the small school.
Well, in a large school, you didn't spend much time professionally talking with your colleagues. You never saw your colleagues' classrooms. You pretty much kept what you were doing to yourself, especially if you might possibly be doing something different than you were mandated to do. Huh. And if there was discussion between teachers about professional matters, it was one that was organized by the principal on something the principal thought was important and was dominated by the principal.
Another thing you've said about giving teachers more ownership of decision-making and collaboration was that in these smaller schools, a core value is the teacher governance itself.
That could be. It could be the core value. That's what I discovered. It didn't have to be. But in a very large school, it's very hard to create an environment where teachers are involved in decision-making. It's possible to run a direct democracy in a small school.
Another thing you've written about the value of teacher governance is that in having this small school where a group of teachers can be more involved in self-governance, young people, the students, get to see what a democratic community looks like.
Oh, you've taken the words out of my mouth. Huh. I know of no other institution we've set up that with the intention of teaching democracy than our public school system. It seems to me it's at the heart of why we created public education and why we need to continue it.
In 2002, the No Child Left Behind Act was signed into law. What impact did you see that have on the public schools that were seeking self-governance?
Well, it made it hard to focus on anything but test scores as a measure of whether something works. And for other reasons, I had become an expert on test scores, and I knew that they were a measure of family wealth, not a measure of student intelligence.
Is that true? I mean,
yes.
You mean that strongly, you're not hinting at that.
No, they are one of the best ways. If you wanted to find out how wealthy families were, give them a standardized test, and there will be exceptions. There's measurement error. But on the whole, it will track from SATs down to second grade tests. It will track their family wealth. You know, it was also observed because of the nature of the test, you can't get better. I mean, one individual can. But the point of a test are to rank order. And just as the children, if I get the children to line up in the playground faster, there will still be exactly the same number of children at the end of the line and the first beginning of the line. There will always be a bottom 5%. It's an example of our disrespect for K-12 education that we can measure whether it works in such a blatantly dishonest way.
When you think back on classes of kids you've had where under other circumstances, they might have been consigned to a dull prison-like school existence that so many children experience. Mm-hmm. What's your best recollection of what kind of difference you can really make to kids who are otherwise consigned to really terrible school experiences?
One thing that comes to mind is we had a very good record of getting kids into colleges. And at one point, since their scores were not unusually high, I did some interviewing of the college people as to why they were so friendly to our kids. And one of the reasons was that they knew how to talk with adults. Huh. They felt comfortable chatting and discussing and having a direct personal relationship between themselves and an academic interviewer. They seemed like interesting people. And in fact, the notion that you have a right to find school interesting and life interesting, I think had an influence. A young man came back to see his sixth grade teacher and said to her, I'm doing fine financially. He was working as a contractor. He said, but you know, I've lost interest. I'm bored with my work. And I remember you said that we should live interesting lives. So I want to talk to you about what else I might do. That was a sign of success.
Yeah.
What advice would you give educators and administrators who would dearly love to create a robust public education system that supports teachers and students, but they don't know where to start?
Well, first of all, they have to decide what they're for. And I would like them first to, I wish first they would realize that they are the only institution in the world that young people live in that might teach them what democracy is. And if they think democracy is of any importance to them or the rest of us, that's what they should ask themselves. What would this school look like? Unfortunately, there are some roadblocks to that that are legal and institutional. They don't have any power in a school, teachers. So that's what I would like to convince the union. Their next contract should be a one-page contract, and the second page should say, and the rest of this should be decided by teachers on site.
Great.
It would be great. I don't know what price we're afraid of paying. I don't know why that would be so hard to do.
Well, Deborah Meyer, thank you for sharing your insights with me and with good reason.
Thank you.
Deborah Meyer has been working in public education as a teacher, principal, writer, and advocate since the early 1960s. She's the founder of several schools, including the Central Park East Public School in New York and the Mission Hill School in Boston. This is With Good Reason. We'll be right back.
Chris, you're not acting like a grown-up in our relationship.
M2!
There's your comic book collection, the race car bed.
I'm young at heart, but I put money into my 401k every paycheck. I'm taking control over my financial life, and that feels pretty grown up to me.
Put away a few bucks, feel like $1 million. For free ideas and easy ways to save, go to feedthepig.org. That's
feedthepig.org.
Are those footy pajamas?
This message brought to you by the American Institute of Certified Public Accountants and the Ad Council.
Every day, across this country, hundreds of college radio stations take to the air, broadcasting music and programming that you won't hear anywhere else.
It's one of the last places where people can really be able to actually say what they want to say.
Without it, you wouldn't have a place for local artists to perform. Certain people need to have a chance, a fighting chance, and college radio is that place for it.
College radio changes the lives of those who are involved with it, and can change those who listen to it too.
This is where we start out, you know, from getting all this great experience working in college radio.
College radio means finding yourself. It helped me find what I wanted to do in not only school, but in life.
So support college radio by continuing to listen to this station and supporting the students who make it happen. College radio, now, more than ever. A message brought to you by this station and the College Radio Foundation. For more information, please visit collegeradio.org.
Welcome back to With Good Reason. I'm Sarah McConnell. Controversy over teacher assessment has swirled in the last decade as more and more emphasis was put on test scores to judge teacher effectiveness. Last year, a teacher in New York sued and won, saying a system tying her evaluation to student scores had misjudged her abilities. So, what makes a good teacher? Is it good test scores? And if not, how can we tell if a teacher is good or bad? My next guest is Linda Darling Hammond. She's president and CEO of the Learning Policy Institute and professor of education emeritus at Stanford. Linda says overhauling teacher assessment is key to improving schools, and it starts way before students are given standardized tests. She says it starts with better entry exams for would-be teachers.
Well, it's really important when you're building a strong profession to have good training and evaluation on the way into the profession, because what you want to do is enable people to come in and be competent right away, as we do in medicine, in nursing, in law, in engineering, and other fields. So many countries around the world that are leading in student achievement have a very strong front end for professional preparation and entry into the profession. And then they don't have to worry so much about evaluating teachers' competence every year because they've made sure they were competent before they got there.
But we don't have a nationwide system of educating teachers for the profession, really, do we? We don't really have a sort of rigorous set of law schools, engineering schools, and in this case, teacher training schools.
Well, we have a state-by-state licensing of teachers. And in some states, right, the preparation expectations are very high. In other states, it's variable. Teachers get in however they can get in. Sometimes they get training, sometimes they don't. Sometimes they get good training, sometimes they get poor training. And the result in those states is a much less high-quality teaching force overall, even if there are some candidates who are very strong.
So, Linda, what would a better teacher entrance exam look like?
Until recently, most of the tests have been multiple choice tests, which didn't actually have any real predictive value about how good a teacher someone would be. Furthermore, many of those tests had discriminatory outcomes, a gap in pass rates between teachers of color and white teachers, and served to reduce diversity in the teaching force. So we've worked on assessment of teachers around how to evaluate whether teachers can plan a lesson and adapt it and adjust it for the needs of their students. Can they teach it? And we videotape them teaching. Can they analyze student learning and figure out what to do next to promote more learning from more students? And those kinds of assessments of teachers really predict how well they're going to do in the classroom, but they also help shape better teacher education. And it turns out that they are not discriminatory by race in their outcomes.
We seem now to be in the throes as a nation of revamping how we evaluate veteran teachers, how we assess and reward and retain the best. Where are we now with this?
Well, we're kind of in a inflection point. There was an effort over the last several years to get states to change their teacher evaluation systems, in part in response to funding from the federal government that came through something called the Race to the Top program. In order to get those funds, states needed to incorporate tests-based evaluation into their system, meaning that teachers would be evaluated in part based on student test scores. That caused a lot of discomfort because it turned out that those measures were highly dependent on which students teachers had. They were very unreliable from year to year and biased towards some teachers and against other teachers. So most states are now trying to move beyond that to systems that really look at teaching practices. They may collect evidence of student learning in a variety of ways, but not driven only by standardized test scores at the end of the year.
Some people have argued that to really raise our schools up to the level of countries like Finland, which seems to be doing this very well, we just need to fire the teachers who perform the lowest every year. You have said, we can't fire our way to Finland. Why not?
Well, we can't fire our way to Finland because the way Finland achieves its goals is by investing a tremendous amount of resource and energy into the preparation of teachers in the first place. And they train them in master's degree programs with full support during that period in very high quality research universities. It's almost like a medical training for teachers. They have teaching schools that are attached to the universities, just like teaching hospitals. Teachers come in highly competent, and then they actually don't spend a lot of energy on evaluation after that. They spend all of their time then on professional learning, teachers learning from each other, the school as a whole, working to improve its practice. If we were simply to fire teachers, without investing in that training, we would not have competent people to replace them.
You've argued that teacher assessment really should be seen more as professional development. How would that work?
Well, in some places that really do a good job of teacher evaluation, they have teachers engaged in setting goals along with their principals about where they want to grow and learn. That's tied to professional learning opportunities that they get in the following year. At the end of that period of time, they can look back and say, how well did I go in achieving my goals? And what do I want to do next year? And you get very strong effects on student learning from collaborative approaches to teacher learning.
How do we do this, though? If we know the best practices for teacher professional development and teacher assessment, it costs money. And how do we ask schools to step up to this level of assessment and development when they're struggling financially?
Well, it costs money to invest in the kind of feedback and evaluation and professional development that helps teachers improve, but it also saves money because it keeps teachers in the classroom longer, which saves the very large costs of teacher attrition. It helps students become more successful, so it saves the costs of summer school and grade retention and other things that have to be done when children are not succeeding. It saves the costs of putting Band-Aids on teachers' practice later in their career because you've invested early in the career to help them become effective. So part of the challenge is helping school districts recognize how this is an investment rather than a cost and how it actually, in the long run, saves a lot of resources that are otherwise spent in much less successful ways.
You have lamented, as others have, that teaching is such a poorly paid profession and that the shortages are too often addressed not by paying better, but just simply lowering the standards of entry. That shortchanges us, right?
Yes, when we address teacher shortages by lowering standards rather than by increasing the incentives to teach, it shortchanges children in a variety of ways, as well as teachers themselves. And it especially shortchanges the most vulnerable children in our society because the hiring of teachers who are unprepared and who often leave at a very high rate because of that underpreparation happens especially for African-American students, Latino students, low-income students in high-need communities.
Are we doing a better job generally for teachers when they step into the classroom? Have we modernized buildings, lowered class sizes, and helped to give them more support to do what is really a very tough job?
It is a very tough job. Some states have really made strong investments in teaching. There are states that spend three times as much on education than other states. And within states, there are some districts that spend three or four times as much on their schools as other districts do. So we have huge inequality. But there are places that are making those investments, and it turns out that they are the higher achieving states in our nation. Unfortunately, however, we are actually spending less on education in the United States today in general than we were in 2007 before the recession really hit. And so we have lost ground in this last decade. Class sizes are larger. Salaries are generally smaller. Investments in schools are weaker. And we're falling further and further behind other countries around the world.
You've been critical in the past about programs like Teach for America. Do you still feel that way?
I think every teacher deserves the very best preparation we can give them. And I think that programs like Teach for America that bring in very eager and enthusiastic and bright recruits do a service in the recruitment, but we also need for those recruits to get strong preparation that will keep them in the profession as a career. And many of them manage to do that, others don't, and it's interesting that among Teach for America alumni, there's a large number that are trying to advocate for residency-style preparation programs for young people coming in, where they get a full year under the wing of an expert teacher in a high-need community while they're getting their credential, and then they start teaching on their own. And I think that's the model we should be working for in the future.
What do you think we lose when we abandon some of these school districts to poverty and allow them simply to languish?
Well, you know, inequality is the Achilles heel in American education. And we have both communities that have been abandoned by the deepening of poverty and concentrated poverty, the growth of resegregation in those communities, and the undermining of the resource base. And that will, if not corrected, haunt this country for many decades to come. At this moment, a society that does not succeed in education for every person cannot much longer survive and succeed in a knowledge-based world. And we ought to be figuring out how to both reduce the levels of poverty and increase the investments in education for children in those communities, for our self-interest as a nation, as well as because it's the moral thing to do.
Linda Darling Hammond is president and CEO of the Learning Policy Institute and professor emeritus at Stanford, where she founded the Stanford Center for Opportunity Policy in Education. Coming up next, teacher unions are hated by some and loved by others. What does research tell us about how they affect schools? For several years now, from both sides of the aisle, teacher unions have been taking hits, and it's showing in decreased membership. Richard Collenberg is a senior fellow at the Century Foundation and an expert in education policy and unions. He argues that strong teacher unions are good for public schools. Rick, it seems like teachers' unions are almost universally demonized in education debates. Why and when did this start happening?
I would put the date primarily to the beginning of the Obama administration. Up until then, Democrats in Washington were mostly supportive of teachers' unions. But when Barack Obama ran for president, he was asked which liberal constituency group he'd be willing to cross, and he said the teachers' unions. Unfortunately, we've seen now somewhat bipartisan denigration of teacher union leaders. Education reform is very, very difficult work, and it is easy for people who get frustrated with the pace of change and improvement to seek out scapegoats.
So what is the case to be made for teacher unions? Could we do fine without them in the public schools?
Well, we know what life was like before teachers' unions existed in their current form. And they were poorly paid. They were micromanaged by authoritarian principals. And they became deeply frustrated with that state of affairs. In the most idealistic sense, teachers' unions stand at the cross-section of the two great engines for equality in our democracy, public education and collective bargaining. Both sets of institutions are critical.
Early on, the complaint about teachers' unions was what? That you can't fire the bad teachers?
Well, I think that really, at the end of the day, the worst criticism of some teachers' unions is that they protect incompetent members. Practically everyone in education has seen a teacher who wasn't doing a good job. I think that has been problematic for teacher unions, and so there's been growing recognition that they need to move beyond it. Many years ago, teachers in Toledo came up with an appropriate response, which is peer assistance and review. So this is a system in which expert teachers come into a school and seek to work with struggling teachers to improve their craft. And if at the end of the day, this individual teacher just simply isn't right for teaching, then the union is involved in counseling those teachers out of the profession and ensuring that that they're not, in fact, in the classroom.
So is peer assessment by teachers, assessing one another, helping get rid of the bad ones where possible, is that widespread and universal or just happening in a few innovative, high-end places?
Yeah, right now, I would say it's not widespread. There's resistance in many cases from management, whose principals are used to being in charge of who's hired, who's fired, and so they become resistant to efforts to kind of democratize the workplace and bring in more teacher voice. So it's a small but growing number of school districts that have embraced this approach.
You found that the districts that do have it actually fire more teachers than districts with the traditional systems?
That's right. So some people initially worried that, if teachers' unions had a role in deciding who was going to be fired, no one would ever get fired. And exactly the opposite happened. It's in the self-interest of teachers to ensure that their colleagues are preparing students well. If you are a sixth grade teacher who's constantly getting students who are unprepared because the fifth grade teacher really doesn't know what he or she's doing, that's a huge source of frustration. And so we found in Montgomery County, Maryland, and Toledo in Cincinnati that the rate of terminations of incompetent teachers increased under peer assistance and review compared with when principals were in charge of decisions.
Oftentimes, the debate sets this up as a zero-sum game between teachers on one side and students on the other, that if the unions help teachers get what they want, the students necessarily lose. Is that fair?
Oh, I think it has it exactly wrong. You know, the American Federation of Teachers used to have a slogan, teachers want what students need. And I think that's basically right. The teachers' unions are fighting for more funding for public education. They're fighting for reductions in class size. They're fighting for better teacher salaries, which can attract, on average, a stronger candidate to the teaching profession. These things are good for students as well. I'm not saying the interests of teachers and students are aligned 100%, but the interests of teachers and students are more closely aligned than virtually any other group in education. certainly than the hedge fund managers who are so supportive of charter schools and have an interest in reductions in taxes, as opposed to teachers who are in the classroom every day and want to make sure that public education is supported.
Is there any evidence that the presence of a strong teachers' union in a school causes worse student outcomes or better student outcomes?
The research is tough to do well. Having said that, there are about 17 studies that over the years have looked at this issue of, does a teacher union increase or reduce academic achievement? And in 12 of those cases, the studies found increases in achievement. 5 of those cases, they found decreases in achievement. But when Robert Carini, who evaluated these studies, looked at them more closely, he found that the most rigorous studies were those that tended to find the most positive effects for students, which intuitively makes sense because teachers are fighting for better working conditions that are connected to the learning conditions of students. And so, on the whole, teachers' unions do improve academic achievement for students, and I think most people who look at the issue will recognize why, that when you improve those working conditions for teachers, you've improved the learning conditions for students.
If we look to some of the schools around the world that have very high student achievement, do we see teacher unions there?
Absolutely. So, in the countries that are beating us academically, places like Finland, what you find is high levels of teacher unionization and low levels of poverty among students. And those two things can often go together. Teachers' unions are part of a larger union movement that is fighting for social equality and reductions in poverty and a stronger safety net. All of those things benefit children, which increases academic achievement. So if we want to draw lessons from abroad, we should be looking to strengthen our teachers' unions rather than weakening them, and really addressing the root causes of academic failure, which are poverty and segregation.
Well, Rick Kallenberg, thank you for sharing your insights with me and with good reason.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
Richard Kallenberg is a senior fellow at the Century Foundation. He's the author of 5 books, including Tough Liberal, Albert Schenker, and The Battles Over Schools, Unions, Race, and Democracy. This program was funded by a grant to Dr. Oliver Hill at Virginia State University by the National Science Foundation. Major support for With Good Reason is provided by the law firm of McGuire Woods and by the University of Virginia Health System, a National Cancer Institute-designated cancer center researching and developing the treatments of tomorrow, uvahealth.com. With Good Reason is produced by the Virginia Foundation for the Humanities. Elliot Majerzik, Allison Quantz, Lilia Fukin, and John Last are our associate producers. Jeannie Palin handles listener services. And our interns are Victoria Joyner, Peter Eckel, and Darren Nguyen. I'm Sarah McConnell. Thanks for listening.
Hi, my name is Liz, and I am the host of the show No Boys Allowed, where every Monday I focus strictly on female artists of every genre. So if you are interested, check me out Mondays 10 to noon. I also have a recipe at the top of the 11th hour, and it could be a recipe of something edible or not, so you never know. Again, my name is Liz, and my show is called No Boys Allowed.
Impact Fourth Tuesday. Every fourth Tuesday at 1 p.m., meet people who are about making a difference in your community. Our programs are designed to be a catalyst that helps nonprofits and other community organizations get the word out to you and help them to reach their goals and potential in serving others. Listen to Impact every fourth Tuesday at 1 p.m. and see who is making a difference.
Dearborn Homecoming is coming up for its 39th year, so join WHFR at the festival August 3rd through 5th from Fort Field Park when we set up a record sale and meet your favorite DJs. Go to thecityofdearborn.org to learn more about the weekend's entertainment featuring the Australian Bee Gees Show and the legendary Homecoming Fireworks on Saturday and Sunday. The 39th annual Dearborn Homecoming will feature rides, music, vendors, food, and community high school reunions on August 3rd through 5th at Fort Field Park located at 500 Monroe Street.
Broadcasting from the campus of Henry Ford College, this is WHFR Dearborn. Listener-supported, non-commercial radio, featuring local and independent artists.
South of Memphis, Tennessee.